As a gay man, I'm also a minority in a Caucasian gay culture. So I just thought, so many things are not yet. I've almost died twice. What does it mean?
Words, as I have always believed, cast shadows. Shadows being a sign they are real. More real, maybe, even than this tumor.
Adam and I are our own mini gay straight alliance because, you know, you got a gay writer and a straight director, and we're bringing different points of view that overlap to the table.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Our news wrap crew took the week off to enjoy the U.S. Thanksgiving holiday, but they'll be back next time with the latest developments in or affecting our global LGBT communities, including the first legal marriage of a gay couple in Argentina, the first same-gender civil union ceremony in Australia, and the U.S. shutdown and resurrection of the Washington Blade and the Southern Voice. On this special program, two celebratory memoirs of survival and recovery, and a movie that dares its audiences to take risks. Our first survivor is gay, Asian, and Canadian, and he might say in no particular order.
This is John Frame for This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine, chatting with Wason Choi, author of Not Yet, at the Brisbane Writers' Festival. Wason, welcome.
Well, thank you.
You're an openly gay Canadian, and there are plenty of openly gay Canadians, but an exceptionally well-acclaimed writer. And as an older man, also, you've got a wealth of life experience, but what you're writing about particularly in Not Yet is in surviving near-death experiences. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, the book, as you know, is called Not Yet, and I was commissioned to write it because I've had two experiences of dying, quote-unquote, and it was a book about, in the end, a love story about what it means to die and be a gay man. And you have to know that I was born in 1939. I'm 70 years old. As long as I can remember, I was always told you have to get married or who will take care of you when you're old and sick and on and on and on. And during the time I grew up, that was drilled into our head. I was the male member of the family, the only son, so I was to be married, make sure I have enough children, be taken care of. And this book is about in 2001 when I had two traumas, an asthma attack, in the middle of which I also had a heart attack. And I was 2 months in the hospital and 6 months of repair work afterwards. And then I had a second episode 4 years after that, and I had a quadruple bypass. So I decided when someone asked me, would I write about these experiences, I said, yeah, I will. I have to know what it means.
When you had your heart attack, you actually also experienced the effect that many people have of having a stroke as well. You had to go through a full recovery of learning how to talk,
yes,
and write.
I was given an induced kind of coma because they had put a ventilator down my throat to animate my lungs. They were going into paralysis because of the asthma attack. And on the third day, as they were raising and lowering my levels of consciousness, I started thrashing about, and I had my heart attack combined with all this. And it was a semi-coma state most of the time. They control the levels of consciousness so they can make sure they're not damaging the brain. If I go too deep, then they may not be able to bring me back. So I had hallucinations. I heard from voices from my past who said, why aren't you married? And, you know, and nevertheless, don't surrender, keep going. It's amazing because in the end, this book turned out to be a love story. It is about myself being single, but sharing my life with two families, extended family members. Now, I'm Asian, but my extended family members are Caucasian. And I have a country family, husband and wife, and their two children are my godchildren. I have a city family, the husband and wife, and their daughter is my godchild. And with the country family, I've been together for about 48 years. And the city family, I've been together for about 26, 27 years. And, you know, I want to, in this book, in a way I didn't realize it, but I'm discovering as I'm talking about the book, people are telling me as if they're coming out of a closet. I'm gay, but I have my own family too, and you just made me realize these are my family. Because I think many gay people, until recently when we were allowed same-sex marriage and all this, or the idea of it anyways, if our families rejected us or if we grew old and they were gone, we were to assume to be alone. We had no family. Well, I can't tell you what it means to me. The people that showed up 24 hours of the day, taking their turn to be with me, made me realize that family is who loves you, which is one of the themes of my book. But above and beyond that was my deeper understanding that we're talking about love. Love has no rules. And people who grew up in my generation, and you recall I'm 70 years old, always thought, well, family is strictly blood and you have to be purely Chinese or Catholic or Irish or Protestant or Jewish or whatever. That's how I grew up. And I was an in-betweener. I became a banana. Born in Canada in a Caucasian colonial culture, I grew up thinking more British literature than Chinese Cantonese opera. And in that sense, I was always an in-betweener. I didn't quite feel I belonged. I wasn't purely this or purely that. There came a time, though, when I wrote my first book, The Jade Peony, in 1995, that I have a story to tell, and it is about all of us who are in-between, including those of us whose sexual orientation is part of that, interlocked oppression of being a race, racial quality in a racist society at the time I was growing up, and never mind the sexual biases. And all in all, I thought, gee, I do have something to write about. And I had the pleasure of writing that book, discovering what it meant to be different even from your own kind, quote unquote, because as a gay man, I'm also a minority in a Caucasian gay culture. So I just thought, you know, so many things are not yet, and I'm not dead. I've almost died twice. What does it mean? And there came a time after the first dual attacks, the asthma and the heart attack, I recovered enough to go back from my home in Toronto to my birth home in Vancouver, British Columbia, and two ghosts showed up in a restaurant. I don't understand it. You know, I wrote for that part of the book, ghosts are everywhere, but I do not believe in them. And yet, I ended up, having an exorcism, not Hollywood style, very gentle, very sweet Buddhist style, to try and understand what this all meant. I never saw the ghosts. They were seen by the hostess of a restaurant that I patronized quite often. She saw them and was able to describe them to me, and these two ghosts were from my past. I was just stunned. One of them was a boy who was 19 when I was 16, 17 years old, and he befriended me. And this was before I was aware consciously of being gay or any of that. And you have to remember, this was the 1950s when nobody had sex. And the language for sex was so, you know, just dirty, never mind anything that was gay. My first three affairs were with women because I literally didn't know. And I'm that generation who was told when I went to university finally and took psychology, the course on Freud suggested that at a certain stage of growing up, people have same-sex affections and crushes, but it's a passing stage. It's part of maturing. And it's a passing phase. And, you know, that helped me rationalize my situation with the woman I was with and the growing up. And finally, eventually, with Stonewall and all this, my own consciousness was raised. But I tell you, if it is a phase, I'm 70 and I'm waiting. And I tell you, I'm happy it hasn't passed. Yep. I'm very pleased about my own life and who I am. So there I was, an in-betweener, a banana, all of this.
And this banana, that's like yellow, that's in Chinese on the
inside,
white on the
inside. Right, you know, and Caribbean people, when I talk about this, because I do a thing on racism, they tell me, oh, you're talking about our Oreo cookies. And that's black on the outside and white on the inside, because I went from growing up wanting to be part of the Cantonese opera company of old Chinatown. I wanted to be a warrior, one of those beautiful people who on stage wore great clothing and jumped and hopped and skipped and sword play. And then I saw cowboy movies and I wanted to be white and ride on a horse. So I became quite banana. And then when we were assimilated into being Canadians, because in 1947, Chinese people were given the right, especially those who were born here, to be Canadian citizens, here being, of course, Canada. And what was interesting was, at that time, I didn't really think much more about that, except, well, that's fair, I am Canadian, so I thought, but I never felt right in those shoes. And shortly after my first duo trauma, not only did the ghosts appear, but I had a chance to make a film in China. And it was about a writer in search of Confucius. And the pressure for me when I was going to China was that when you go to China, you'll see how Chinese you are, and you'll know you're Chinese because you know all this. And all the elders who were still alive, they were just barely able to contain themselves. And I stood in front of the temples of Confucius, tributes to Confucius and so on, and in a genealogy house where it's the longest one in written history of the people who were born since the time of Confucius in that bloodline. And I looked around and I thought, you know what? I'm a tourist here. I'm in China admiring the philosophy, the art, the temples, the sculptures, the paintings. I'm a tourist. I am a Chinatown boy. I'm a gay man. I am my own person. And I'd rather have a fortune cookie. And so really, not to trivialize anything, but you know, a fortune cookie, which people think is Asian, is really created and invented in San Francisco, apparently. So I just want to declare the right of everybody to be whoever they are, and realize that if they're in between anything, my gosh, when I knew I was going to die at one point, I thought, you know, I've had the best of both worlds. I am a bridge to two cultures. I'm at a banquet table where all my life I have been given the right in Democratic Canada to choose what I need and to respect and leave behind what I didn't want from either culture. And then there was fusion, which makes Canada and much of America now a multicultural possibility, a glimpse of heaven. And I just had all these experiences and I felt I needed to get this down on paper. So I wrote, "Not Yet," because I'm still here.
Tune in for the conclusion of John Frame's illuminating conversation with writer Wason Choi.
I think truly there is a situation where human beings have no other reason but to be family. And that's the only word. It shouldn't depend on bloodline or on being straight and officially okayed by religion or by civil law. It is human beings making contact when it matters.
Next time on This Way Out.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
Have you checked our website for the latest This Way Out update? For a review of recent programming and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, just log on to www.thiswayout.org.
Our award-winning entertainment reporter Steve Pride previews a different kind of movie about teenage romance and relationships later in the program. Next up on this special edition of This Way Out, a review of the latest offering by a popular lesbian author whose magical writing, says our queer lit commentator Janet Mason, examines a reality that is neither pretty nor pink.
When I sat down to read Called Back, My Reply to Cancer, My Return to Life, published in 2009 by Allison Books, by lesbian writer Mary Capello, I came to the realization that I was viewing a life through the portal of cancer, the surprise diagnosis that changes everything. At the same time, Called Back offers an intimate view into the body and culture of breast cancer, which some studies suggest affects lesbians at a slightly higher rate than heterosexual women. It is ironic, perhaps, that breast cancer's public image is pretty and pink, that cosmetic pink gift bags are handed out to some survivors, and that some popular magazines have glamorized women with breast cancer. Capello asks if the same thing would ever have been done to men. Would magazines vaunt their virility, their manly sex appeal as men who are living with cancer? The answer is no, of course, that men are free to face their illness as human beings rather than as gender stereotypes. Capello, the author of two previous books of literary nonfiction, Night Bloom and Awkward, A Detour, redefines the meaning and experience of having breast cancer in her characteristic translucent writing style, and in doing so examines the changes in her mind as well as her body. For starters, she begins to question reality. This is not a dream, your hand on my thigh, people in rowboats, oboe and tympanum. Your kiss, your hair, this beehive, water lily, sneeze, this braid, this lock, this emerald gnarled day. These peaks of desire are real. My name is Mary, and words, as I have always believed, cast shadows. Shadows being a sign they are real, more real, maybe, even than this tumor. Mary writes that she begins to feel closer to the women in her treatment group, women who are otherwise strangers to each other, than she does with her closest friends who are not associated with the place she calls Cancerland. The diagnosis even transforms the way she views her longtime partner, Jean. I know this profile. I have loved it for many years. I never thought I would be glimpsing it from inside the force-taught turning of my own body beneath the heavy slab of a gamma-ray machine. But I know this profile. I awoke to it in freezing Buffalo mornings decades ago when my eyes would open earlier than Jean's, and instead of getting up or waking her, I would, leaning on my side, study her profile and marvel at the fact that I was in bed with a medieval prince. She finds that, in the hospital where she is admitted, that there is no box on the form to reflect her lesbian identity. When filling out the form, she left the section blank. When someone from the hospital calls to ask if she is single, married, divorced, or widowed, Mary replied that she is domestic partnered. The hospital representative on the phone says, "Okay, I'll put you down as married, but I am not married," Mary responds. The woman replies that she would put Mary down as single, and when Mary protests, she says, "Then I'll put you down as married." Even while facing her own struggles, Mary feels compassion for her, quote, classmates in her cancer group and for the other people that she sees when going for treatment, including children. And when her treatment is done, thoughts of the others stay with her. When she receives the results of her first post-treatment mammogram, she is told that all cancer is gone and that she has to monitor herself for signs of a reoccurrence. The surgeon explains that a reoccurrence of an original cancer is worse than a new cancer because it means the disease resisted all that medicine had to offer. On her release, she thinks of cats and how they refuse to come when you call them. Mary poses the question, "Can I refuse to come the next time cancer calls me?" With commentary on queer life and literature, this is Janet Mason for This Way Out.
It's that time of year again when many of you in the U.S. consider ways to maximize your annual charitable tax deductions. Unlike many other worthwhile causes, we can't survive without your help. Log on to thiswayout.org to get some unique musical, cultural, and historical programming from the This Way Out archives and further reduce your U.S. tax liability. No matter where you are in the world, we can't go on without you. Log on to thiswayout.org to help keep this program on the air. From the This Way Out family to you and yours, thank you and happy holidays.
A short that drew raves on the gay festival circuit in 2005 has grown into a new feature-length film in 2009. This Way Out Entertainment reporter Steve Pride goes behind the scenes with its out screenwriter and straight but not narrow director.
I'm Adam Salke, the director of Dare.
David Brin, the writer and co-producer of Dare.
Dare is about two best friends, a guy and a girl, in the last semester of high school who romantically pursue the same guy, Johnny, who's kind of the bad boy in school, in a last-ditch effort to shake things up before they graduate.
Alexa, I have my first kiss tonight.
What? With who?
I also gave my first blowjob. Do you think I'm disgusting?
Yes. I think it's absolutely disgusting to give a blowjob on your first date. Oh, you're a total whore, and that's final.
So you don't think...
Do you really think I didn't know? Hey, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
Who was it?
Johnny.
What inspired the character of Johnny?
I certainly had a Johnny in my life, which is not to say that I replicated this person, but he certainly was the inspiration for me. It was somebody who, as he moved through high school and just the world in general, he seemed to have an ease and a gracefulness to him that I felt was so foreign that I could never experience what he experienced. And he was beautiful and smart, and there was clearly something below the surface, but I think at first glance you didn't necessarily see it. And I was very interested in portraying Johnny in the film, and Zach Guilford really did an incredible job of this, in showing the vulnerability that is just below the surface, but that comes out for a very specific reason, which is his desire to be wanted and loved and to feel a part of a larger group or a family. You know, I just really wanted to explore that guy that we've all kind of had, or girl, who seems untouchable and unaffectable and so outside of our realm of existence, but you may just be surprised that you are able to connect to that person and relate to them, even if only briefly.
How is being a gay teen different today?
Oh, I think it's very different. I never even dreamed of coming out in high school. It didn't even seem like an option to me. It was like the death knell.
There was no one out in my high school when I was...
We did. We had one girl who was bisexual, I think. Who knows if she was actually bisexual or if that was just another statement in addition to like the black nail polish. We had a kid working on the film as his senior project, because we shot actually at my high school for part of it, mm-hmm. who came out when he was 14. And had tons of friends, was like the vice president of the student council. Again, it's not like that everywhere, but I think we have come a long way in terms of kids being able to express their sexuality much earlier.
Who's the audience for this film?
Young people, for sure. People in college and high school really respond to this film because they feel like it accurately portrays what they are going through. And the thing
across
about...
Across the sexual spectrum.
Right. The thing about sexuality, I think, now with young people is that it's different. People perceive it differently than even when I was in high school. Obviously, this is not true across the country, but in a lot of places in America, high school, the sexuality is considered much less of a hot topic issue. It just is. Kids are coming out at 13, 14. There was that whole article in the New York Times magazine about kids coming out in middle school. So I think that they see sexuality as a little bit more fluid, and they just kind of accept that, oh yeah, so-and-so is gay. Obviously, the gay audience. And I think the art house crowd, older people, have really been responding to this because not only does it evoke things, you know, watching their kids go through this, but they remember so vividly. I mean, people are coming up to us who are in their 50s and 60s talking about their experience of being in high school and how it really captured something that took them back in a way that they really enjoyed. So I think our audience is a lot broader. You know, certainly one of our characters is gay, and there is certainly gay content in the film, but at least for me, I never intended it to be a quote-unquote gay film. Not that that's a bad word. I think that if that's what you're all you want, that Dare probably isn't going to be just that, a gay film.
One of the things that's exciting about the story for Dare and was exciting about the script when I first read it is that we have one straight character, one gay character, and one character whose sexuality is maybe fluid and it's not so clear about where he falls in the spectrum. And each character gets their own piece of the story. So it could appeal to a large audience.
I think it also helps that Adam and I are our own mini gay straight alliance, because, you know, you got a gay writer and a straight director, and we're bringing different points of view that overlap to the table.
What do you want people to take away from Dare?
I think that you have to take risks in order to figure out who you are or who you're not. And all the characters in the film take a risk. They all have what I started to call a moment of daring, where they go after something that they really want. In fact, we've been on Twitter with the film, and we started saying one of our favorite lines of the film that actually became the movie's tagline, "Do something you're afraid of," over Twitter, at Dare the Movie, which is our Twitter handle, and people really started to respond to it, and they started to write in with all these risks that they had taken. And it's actually, I think, something that really resonates with people, because I think in life you have to take chances in order to get the things you want. And in taking those chances, you figure out a piece of who you are or who you're not.
And also, especially for young people, but I think for all of us, to realize that our perceptions of somebody immediately as we see them do not constitute the entire being of that person, and that sometimes it pays to look a little bit deeper and not write people off simply because you assume that they are, using the high school metaphors, like, you know, the bad girl or the good girl or the bad boy and the outsider and the loser, is to take a moment and take a second look, and you may be surprised at what you find, and that you actually may connect to somebody who you never thought you could possibly have any kind of relation to.
The two of you have sort of formed your own gay-straight alliance. What have you learned from each other?
What I've taken from it, especially in going to the gay film festivals with this, as well as the mainstream festivals, is that it is really all about the emotions behind things, you know, and that just because somebody's sexuality may not be the same as yours or is even different than the characters, that doesn't mean they can't relate to the emotions behind the driving of it. The gay story will always be unique. We always are going to face unique challenges, especially in developing and adolescence, but that doesn't mean that it's not relatable. And I think that I really loved seeing Adam push himself to relate to the, especially because I think the character, especially in the short, that he related to most was Ben. That was the character he related to. And that was exciting to me, to have him approach that and tackle the story. And also, he directed some really sexy scenes between boys, you know, and that's great. And it was, you know, it's not because he suddenly discovered he was gay or because he's suddenly, you know, going to turn bi on us all, just as I'm certainly not about to start, like, you know, making out with Emmy Rossum. But it was really exciting to me that he just went there. It wasn't even an issue or a question, and he knew that it had to be sexy. And I think he finds it sexy, even though he may not want to have sex with the guys. I think he finds it sexy.
I did.
We can both appreciate, you know, Zach Guilford's body and Emmy Rossum's body together.
Definitely.
This has been a conversation with director Alan Salke and screenwriter David Brind. Their film, Dare, stars Emmy Rossum, Zach Guilford, Sandra Bernhardt, and Alan Cumming. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, John Frame, Sherry Lund, Janet Mason, Christopher Gall, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Josie Cotton sang Johnny, Are You Queer? And Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is only made possible by donations from our listeners, and we thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to support our work, listen to our podcasts, read this week's news wrap, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alert, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WOMR Provincetown, Massachusetts, 3OCR Colac, Victoria, KOPN Columbia, Missouri, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.